Hello, welcome to part two of our suicide series. This is Healthy Minds. I'm Julie, your host. So we're going to quickly introduce ourselves again, but if you want to hear more, you should listen to our last episode. So if you guys can just say hi.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Katie Dant. I'm the Assistant Director of Crisis Services at Grassroots Crisis Intervention Center here in Howard County.
And I'm Tina Field. I'm the Hotline Manager at Grassroots.
And I'm Rowan Powell. I'm the Transitional Age Youth Outreach Project Coordinator at Honor and of Maryland.
Nice. Quite a mouthful.
It is. Okay,
so we left off last episode talking about self-harm, and so I just want to remind everyone that this is all about suicide, so we're going to do our little trigger warning. So here it is. This is your trigger warning. We're going to be discussing suicide, means, plans, attempts, suicidal thoughts, and self-harm. So if at any time in this episode you feel like you need to talk to someone, please call 1-800-273-8255 or Grassroots at 410-531-6677. Okay, so we were talking about accidental self-injury self-injury leading to accidental suicide. Mm-hmm. And so I know that we wanted to talk about substance use there.
Definitely. Substance use disorders in general are oftentimes co-occurring with mental health disorders and oftentimes include suicidal ideation. When we talk about substance use, you don't have to have a substance use disorder in order to have suicidal ideation while you're intoxicated, but we find that it's nearly impossible to safety plan with somebody who is intoxicated.
Right.
Because they are not in their regular state of mind. They don't have the ability to cognitively work through that and connect. And so safety planning becomes really, really difficult. And people are super high risk when they're intoxicated because they're far more impulsive.
Right.
So usually that's when we see a lot of times when we need intervention to be sent to somebody who's actively suicidal and actively intoxicated.
We also know that a period of relapse can put somebody at higher risk of suicide, particularly after a significant period of recovery or abstinence from substances. And a lot of that relates to what we talked about in the last episode about the social stuff involved in Joyner's theory. Many times people's family and friends and loved ones put a lot of work and effort and money and time into helping their loved one get clean and sober. We see this at Grassroots. We are one of the referral sources for substance use treatment in Maryland, and half of our calls seeking treatment are from loved ones, that families and friends really want to see their loved ones get clean. Mm-hmm. So if a person relapses, they feel like they've let down everybody who loves them. They are filled with shame and they want to isolate and they feel like a failure, and that can put them at particularly high risk. So when we're talking about relapse, it's part of the recovery process. It happens. Nobody is perfect. They had the skills to get clean in the first place. Let's work together, bring that social network back around them to help support them in getting clean again so that they don't stay at risk of suicide or stay at risk of long-term health implications from substance use.
Absolutely.
I think it's also worthwhile to note that alcohol and drugs can also be used as a self-injurious behavior there.
Yeah.
And people will sometimes also combine medications with that with the intent to self-injure, not to die by suicide. And so, for instance, I had a young lady, a client, who told me that she would take ibuprofen and wash it down with a beer because she deserved to feel that way. And so that's a rather dramatic example, I think, but an important example to talk about, you know, the dangers of mixing medications and sometimes the intention behind, again, where the delineation lies there.
Right. Yeah, many mental health medications don't mix well with alcohol.
No, right.
That it can increase the side effects, it can increase the drowsiness, it can put you at higher risk when doing things like driving, that, you know, being really careful about mixing specifically alcohol, but of course other substances with psychiatric medications is important.
Right. It can intensify a lot of things, and those thoughts really can become intensified, and somebody can be drunk and totally suicidal and on the phone on the hotline just not able to really connect, and then as soon as they're sober again, I'm not suicidal.
Right.
I don't feel like taking my life at all. So we really need to be careful when we're looking at that.
Yeah.
And I think personally the closest that I ever got to attempting was on drugs when I was in college.
Yeah.
Because it took away well, A, the impulse control, but also the guilt that I had always associated with attempting was how I would upset people. I wasn't thinking about that anymore.
Right.
The things holding me back weren't really there anymore. Right.
Yeah.
There was a level of numbing, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we mentioned it's really difficult to safety plan with the substance use. So I think typically what's done is means restriction. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, we do try to definitely restrict means when we can. When we're talking on the phone with somebody, do you have your means available? Mm-hmm. Is there a way you can separate yourself and put physical distance between the means is what we talk about.
Right. So if somebody, this is when somebody has a clear plan or they're in a situation that puts them at particularly high risk of lethality, that we, if their plan involves overdosing, we will ask them to put the medication or put the substance in a drawer or in another room or give it to somebody until the crisis is over. Particularly with firearms, means restriction is incredibly important that we don't want to take people's guns. That's not our mission, but we want to get the guns out of their reach while they're in suicidal crisis.
Right.
So we talk to them about, is there somebody that can lock up your firearm for you? Can your uncle hold on to it? Can somebody else hold it until you and your therapist feel like you're in a safer place to have the firearm back in your home?
Absolutely.
So that's really important. Also, when we're talking about means restriction, we know that one of the most frequent ways that people die is through suffocation, and that's a really hard thing to restrict means for. But it is important for us to know and to talk about that if we are seeing people practice ways to cut off their oxygen, to asphyxiate themselves, we need to pay attention to that and try to get those things out. If people are researching, there's lots of horrible websites that teach people how to kill themselves, and many of them involve suffocation. So if you find that in your people's internet history or things like that, that's something to think about getting things out of the house too.
Mm-hmm. So last episode, we talked about like some of the stats around means. Mm-hmm. Can we like pop that back in there really fast?
Definitely.
So we know that 51% of people who die by suicide do so with a firearm. Mm-hmm. So that's why when we talk about means restriction, getting firearms out of the house until the crisis is over is so important.
Right. Suffocation is one of the second leading causes, and it's the number one cause for young people. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's the number one cause for females age 15 to 24, and for older females over age 24, the most common cause is poisoning.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or overdose.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
We know that men are more likely to die by suicide. They're three times more likely to die because men are more likely to use those lethal means. They're more likely to own firearms, and they're more likely to use firearms, particularly in our senior citizens. We know that elderly men die at higher rates of suicide because, again, they're more likely to be gun owners, and they're more likely to use firearms to kill themselves with.
Right. Women are three times more likely to attempt suicide, but often we see a little less, lower lethality means is what I'm looking for. They attempt more, but less suicides.
Right. Okay. So we're approaching crisis, right? We're using our means here.
Right.
So let's talk about what those signs we should look out for. What are these breadcrumbs or red flags or... goodness, let's check in on this person.
We talked about in the last episode basically any major change in behavior.
Right.
So if a person is pulling out of social activities, if they're withdrawing from family and friends, they're giving away prized possessions, they're saying things like, pretty obviously, I'm going to kill myself, or I'm not going to be here much longer, or I just want to go to sleep and not wake up, or I don't know how to deal with things, or I can't handle this anymore. I just want to feel better. I can't make it another day. If they're saying stuff like that and they're pulling away from the world, or they're really angry all the time.
We see that with men more.
We see that with men more. Mm-hmm. You're right. That with men, often depression doesn't come out the way it would with me. If I'm depressed, I go to bed with a pint of Ben and Jerry's. But for a guy who is not socialized the same way I was, that's not as acceptable as it is for me. If I go to bed with a pint of Ben and Jerry's, one of my friends is going to come over and sit with me and probably feed me the Ben and Jerry's and right. cry with me.
But that's we're going to talk about
that's
it.
That's not as socially acceptable for my 20-year-old son,
right.
who, if he's depressed, acts out and yells at people mm-hmm. or punches things or drives fast or does mm-hmm. other risky behaviors mm-hmm. that for him is manifesting depression in a different way than me. So right. for him, that would be out of the ordinary because thank God he's a rule follower. So so acting like that would be completely out of the ordinary for him. It'd be more socially acceptable, but I would have to be like, hey, what's up here? Because this isn't your typical behavior. What is going on?
Right.
So if we see stuff like that, anything outside the norm of people's normal self, right. their typical stuff, we right. want to ask what's going on.
Increased substance use. All the signs that we see for depression, like excessive sleeping or maybe not sleeping very much at all,
right.
you know, when we're talking about mania. So there's these other pieces, too, that right. you can
eating
be looking
more,
for.
Eating less, mm-hmm. Decreased hygiene, decreased grades, less job performance going down, mm-hmm. Financial crisis, mm-hmm. Fear of going to jail. We have a lot of people on the hotline who enter suicidal crisis because jail is terrifying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so they think that killing themselves is a way to get out of that.
Yeah.
So those kind of things, any mm-hmm. major life crisis combined with their coping skills not being as strong as they've been before can put somebody in a suicidal crisis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And definitely trauma,
right.
especially for young adults.
Thank you. Yeah. Absolutely trauma. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of the things that we're talking about right now, if you're thinking about a teenager, you know, some of this stuff is just typical teenage behavior. It's like, oh, my God, my teenager's doing all of these things. Well, what's typical for a teenager and what's outside the norm? And that's when we really need to tune mm-hmm. in as parents or teachers or caregivers or whoever we might be to that person. Is this out of their norm?
Mm-hmm.
And really paying attention to that.
Yeah. So picking up new activities for a teenager, totally normal, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not playing violin anymore, Mom. You made me do it for 11 years. I'm done, right?
Right.
That's not necessarily a sign. What would be a sign is if they stopped playing violin and then also dropped all their friends and then were sitting in their room all day. And then you'd want to put up your little red flag and say, something's going on. Right. I should check in on my people.
This is a really specific instance, but giving away concert tickets.
Huh. Yeah.
I've seen that a lot with young adults is like young adults love concerts.
Yes.
And so frequently they have the access to go to them. Then all of a sudden they're giving them away.
Yeah,
I've seen that a lot. It's kind of like this is really out of the norm for your behavior.
This is the giving away your belongings or mm-hmm. putting your affairs in order.
Right.
I had a friend in high school that we always knew her as like the messy room girl. Like, and most teenagers have some form of messy room, but like, whoa, we needed like hazmat suits to hang out in there. And one day we went over and it was really clean and we were like, what happened?
Yeah.
So that would be something you want to look out for as well. And of course, let's talk about social media for a hot second here. It is like a double-edged sword or two-sided coin or whatever you know we want to use here. But one, it connects you, but it also doesn't connect you. And there's a lot of studies being done around social media right now.
Right.
And I think since the introduction of the iPhone, is that right, that there's been a steep increase in teenagers thinking about suicide and feeling less connected with their peers. I was at your wonderful suicide symposium last year. Grassroots has a suicide symposium they do every year, and it's going to be rescheduled, so you guys have a chance to go.
Right.
So check it out. I learned about social media's impact on teenagers in particular, and the impact on suicidal ideation amongst teens. And this, like, you're kind of connected, but you're not. You're not reading the person's body language. You're not with them, so you don't maybe get that same warm, fuzzy feeling there.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, social media and the internet can be a source of support, really, for young people. It's a way that they do connect with technology, but it can also be a negative thing as well, depending on what they're sharing, who they're sharing with, the types of things that they're looking up on the internet.
Right.
You know, sometimes they might be, you know, talking to each other about things that they're experiencing, and they're sharing in an experience together, and so they're connecting with each other. But then you can also look at that as potential contagion, because you know, somebody might be talking about cutting, and another person's talking about their experience with cutting, and maybe sharing worse and worse cuts.
Yeah.
And then you're really going down a steep hill at that point.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break, so stay tuned.
Grassroots Crisis Intervention Center is the only 24-hour crisis center and homeless shelter located in Howard County.
The Crisis Center offers 24/7 walk-in and phone counseling for all sorts of issues, including housing crisis, family challenges, substance misuse, mental health issues, and thoughts of suicide.
If you or a loved one needs support or during a challenging time, grassroots counselors are available for you.
You can call our hotline at 410-531-6677 or come into our center at 6700 Freetown Road in Columbia.
We're here for you.
Hello, welcome back to Healthy Minds. We're going to hop back in to talking about suicide. So a quick trigger warning in case you're listening after a break here. We are talking about suicide, means, ideation, attempts, all that stuff. So if you become overwhelmed, please call 1-800-273-TALK or 8255 or grassroots at 410-531-6677. So we just wrapped up talking about some warning signs and risk factors and things that might make your antenna go up or mm-hmm. you kind of worried about your people. So we know we just blurted all that at you on a podcast. But if you want the actual physical information, you can go to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's website, which is AFSP.org. And also, there's a wonderful advocate. His name is Kevin Hines, and we're going to fill you in about him now.
Yeah, Kevin Hines has been doing a lot of work around suicide prevention and intervention for years now. He is actually a survivor of suicide attempt off of the Golden Gate Bridge, one of few who have attempted off the bridge and survived to talk about it. And one of the really important pieces that I want to talk about with Kevin's story is ambivalence. You know, when people are talking about suicide and suicidal ideation, there's an ambivalence there. It's that they, on one hand, feel like they don't want to be here anymore. They want the pain to end. On the other hand, they don't really want to do it. That's a permanent solution to usually a temporary problem. Mm-hmm. And when Kevin talks, he talks about how as soon as his hands left the rail, he had instant regret. He did not want to be in that situation anymore and wanted to live. Mm-hmm. So ambivalence is a really, really big thing we talk about when we talk about suicide and suicidal ideation.
And we know that anytime somebody reaches out or shows signs to the world that they're in trouble, that they're in crisis, they show all those warning signs we talked about, or they say the things that we talked about them saying, there's some ambivalence there. They want people to pay attention. They mm-hmm. want help. They want connection. We are designed or created or have evolved to be social creatures. So people put things out there to get that connection, because that connection is what's going to help them manage their symptoms or diminish their crisis and get back to a better place.
Let's talk about safety planning. So like activating this turning point or ambivalence on how to keep somebody safe.
So the first thing we need to do is make sure that we agree that they're thinking about suicide. So asking them is really important. If we're seeing all these risk factors, if they're saying the things that make our antenna go up, we need to ask. We need to ask, are you thinking about suicide? And we can say, you know, I've noticed that this is going on, that you're not coming out as much, that school isn't as important, that you're fighting with your parents a lot, that you're having trouble with money, that, you know, you seem worried a lot, you seem depressed. Mm-hmm. Are you thinking about suicide? Or sometimes when people are overwhelmed like you are, they think about suicide. Is that what's going on with you? Find out if that's where their mind is, because then we can work with that. There's something we can do about that. And if that's not where their mind is, there's still something going on, and you're not going to hurt them by asking. You're showing that you're paying attention. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we are social creatures and we want to be paid attention to. Mm-hmm. We all want to be cared about, and showing that you care about somebody who's in crisis is really important. When somebody is in a suicidal crisis, it's sometimes really hard for them to pick up the phone and call a hotline or go to a doctor and say, this is what I'm thinking about. So being able to fill that gap for them or be that hand out or be that bridge is such a gift that we can give to the people in our lives.
Yeah. I think I've heard, and you know, you guys can back me up on this, that a lot of people feel relief at being asked directly this question because they're like, oh, somebody gets it. And so we're back to this connection and being human.
Yeah.
Right. Rowan talked about feeling ashamed when her doctor was like, hospital. You know, and that's not what we want for people. We want them to feel like it's okay to talk about what's going on in their mind. So if we can ask in a straightforward way, if we can use the word suicide, it makes them think, oh, somebody gets it. It's okay. I'm normal. People have these thoughts. And it removes the shame and the stigma and the judgment and lets us have an open conversation about what really is going on.
Yeah.
I think once the language became something my mother and I were comfortable with using, it became easier for me to tell her what I was feeling and became easier for us to go off of that. Like, we created our own version of safety plan, which is essentially if I tell her, I have to give her 48 hours notice before I kill myself. That's a very non-serious kind of safety plan, but it's worked for me because I know that I can have that conversation with her. I'm not afraid of her being like, oh, we have to go now. It's time to go to the hospital. It's just a kind of way for me to say, I'm thinking about this. And then we can have a conversation based off it, with this, like, what's going on?
Right.
Why are you upset? What do you need right now?
Right.
Once the language became something we could use, it became so much easier for us.
I
just want to talk about, you know, and emphasize the being direct when asking, because, you know, there has been a stigma around the word suicide, and people are scared to say the word. And with that, you know, you don't always get the information of, are they actually thinking about suicide or are they not? Because, you know, Tina's talked about before in her work on the hotline when she first started that she asked a guy, are you thinking about hurting yourself? And he was not at all thinking about that. He was thinking about killing himself. But it took a while to get back to that actual conversation because we're skirting around the actual word.
Yeah, I said, are you thinking about hurting yourself? And he said, I used to cut, but I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And I thought I was asking him if he was thinking about suicide, but that's not how he interpreted it. So using the word is so important, because that gets us to a place that we're talking about the same thing, and that we can move on from there.
Right. And there's this taking away of fear. If you're using the word, then I can use the word because it's okay for me to use the word.
Right.
It's taking ownership of it.
Yeah. Right.
Especially if you're the person asking about someone, like, if they're okay. You taking ownership of the word allows them to talk about how they're feeling.
Yeah. So if we go back to my story about my little sister who was 11 and shared with me that she was just all over the place, right? Crying. She had been self-harming and, you know, just really not doing well in school. And I had just started in the mental health field. And so I had enough knowledge to make me dangerous, I like to say. So I sat down with her and I was like, you know, listen, I'm really worried about you. You're acting really differently. Like, I know teenage years are hard, even though she was 11, not really a teenager. But, you know, I know teenage years are hard. Can we talk about what's going on with you? And so finally, I realized that we were heading to this point where I had to ask this question. And oh, my goodness, that was my baby sister. And I had to ask this question. It was horrible.
Right.
But I did it and I kept it together and I got her help. And we did take her to the hospital because that's what she needed. And I have to tell everybody that's listening now, I can't ask that question again. I can't. Yeah, not for my family. And so that's okay. So it's really important that you take care of yourself, too. So if that's going to be triggering for you, or you know, you have a, I guess, traumatic experience asking someone, then you want to make sure that you can still be there and support them. But like, now I know that I could call one of my friends and they would come sit with me to talk with my sister, and I can be there, but I wouldn't be able to say those actual words.
Right. That's important, too, that you never have to be alone when you're trying to talk to somebody who might be suicidal. And if you can't ask that question, then definitely find somebody who can be there and ask that for you and be with you. So absolutely.
And you can call our hotline or call the National Suicide Hotline to talk about how to talk to somebody about suicide. That a lot of our calls are from family and friends of people at risk. So people call in and we do just what we're doing here. We have the conversation about the risk factors and the stuff that they're seeing and how to have that conversation and where to send that person. So if somebody calls in and their person is at risk of suicide, we can even do a conference call with them and help them ask that, or they can bring their loved one into Grassroots and we can have a conversation together and try to help keep them safe and direct them toward resources that'll help them not reenter that kind of crisis.
Yeah, I would like to say two things. So one is practice actually saying the question before you get there, because it sounds really easy in your head, and then all of a sudden you're trying to get the words out of your mouth, and it doesn't go.
Super awkward.
It's so awkward. So you all may laugh at me, but I literally stood in front of a mirror and just asked my reflection if I was thinking about suicide multiple times. And then now I'm comfortable enough using the word, because most of us don't use the word in our everyday life. And so practice saying it. There's a really goofy resource, seizetheawkward.org.
Yep.
It's hilarious. Mm-hmm. I love their little like commercials or PSAs. And so it's a really good way to start the conversation. So let's share some of our other favorite resources then about asking about suicide.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm going to plug Grassroots, because we are employees of Grassroots and we do a lot. But Grassroots is a crisis center. We answer for the National Suicide Hotline. We answer for Maryland Crisis Line. We have our own Grassroots line. You can get a live person 24/7. So that's super good. We also have an app called There Is Hope that you can download. It's free, and it's a self-assessment, or if there's somebody that you know that you feel like might be struggling, you can go through and answer a few questions, be directly connected to our hotline or the National Suicide Hotline if you're not in our area.
And the There Is Hope app through Grassroots is about to update, where we can do real-time safety plans with people. So if somebody calls in to Grassroots Hotline and they have the app, the counselor on the phone with them can help them create a safety plan to talk about what their risk factors are, how to recognize if they're at risk again, who to call, where to go, what to do, and upload that to that person's app. So they can have that on their phone, in their pocket, all the time, that if they start feeling like they're entering that crisis again, they can pull this out and be like, oh, I've done this before, I can do this again, this is how I'm gonna keep myself safe.
Yeah, and having worked with young adults for quite some time, I can't tell you how much time and thought we've put into making a safety plan on paper, and I found it later in the trash.
Right.
So I think it's great that it's on the phone.
Yeah, they're not throwing their smartphones away. It's
not
going to be in their pocket all the time.
Yeah.
The Trevor Project has a suicide prevention hotline, I think online as well, specifically for young adults that are identify as LGBTQ. But since my work is primarily with young adults, I see them being more comfortable using any kind of service that is text related or online related, because it kind of takes away that anxiety of I'm on the phone with a stranger talking about what's upsetting me right now.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and I think it's worthwhile to note 741-741, the crisis text line, which I have previously promoted and still promote, has a really long wait time now because people have learned about it and they're really excited about it and they're using it. But we're seeing wait times up to like 2 hours on the regular.
Right.
And so if this is something immediate, it may be, well, no, it is better to just call.
Right. If you don't get a response in about 15 minutes, then definitely use another avenue. Call the National Suicide Hotline, call Grassroots.
Or use the online chat services at Trevor Project or the National Suicide Hotline, and you can talk to a counselor that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so it's time to wrap up again. This episode was long, if you've been listening to both parts. It's heavy. We talked a lot about hard subjects. And so it's really important that everybody practices self-care that's listening. I know that I'm going to practice some self-care this afternoon. And I know that we're going to share some more tips for you. So I'll start us off here and say that I love getting into a blanket burrito. I just wrap myself up in my fuzziest blanket and I just sit there and I watch some trashy rom-com and it's great and my brain's off and I feel connected with people even though I'm a blanket burrito in my living room. So
I have a weird self-care, and not many people will share this, but I clean. My staff at work even knows that if I'm straightening up the hotline room, that I just need a couple minutes. It just helps me feel like I'm putting the world back in order. It makes everything kind of look straighter, feel neater, and it just helps me feel refreshed and ready to get back out there.
Yeah. In the last episode, I talked about meditation and flow art stuff. But when I get really stressed out, I do a whole self-care star chart. I don't think we get enough gold stars as adults, maybe even as kids. But I list out all the different types of self-care things I can do for myself in a day, whether it's brushing my teeth or making sure that I've cooked myself a meal instead of just eating out or whatever it may be. As many as I can mark off, and I'm like, oh, I got 6 stars today. So that's a really good way to kind of keep yourself on track.
Personally, cooking is one of my biggest coping skills. It was kind of something I learned from my grandmother. But when I get really, really stressed, I will go to the store and then buy some chicken and make North Carolina barbecue. And that makes everything better.
That's awesome.
I'm going to get ice cream when we leave here.
I mean, in bed with Ben and James.
Yeah, self-care after this podcast is important.
Yeah. So thank you again, everybody, for being here, for listening. Stay tuned for our next episode, which is actually going to be on LGBTQ. We're going to have Katie and Rowan returning and, you know, learning all about mental health today. It's great that you're listening. So goodbye and good mental health.
Thank you.